curious, perhaps it could be added to the museum after this.
Whatever you're looking for, we've got sounds for that.
Join us for topical conversation that informs, challenges, inspires, and really gets you thinking on Woman's Hour.
Or relax and unwind with the rich musical textures of a mindful mix.
Or throw caution to the wind and enjoy Friday night comedy whenever you darn well please, like on a Tuesday, or even not at night, with the sensationally time-flexible Friday Night Comedy Podcast.
Music, radio, podcasts. Listen on BBC Sounds.
Now on Radio 4, John Lloyd returns with Anna Tashinsky to the Museum of Curiosity for an episode full of fitness, fantasy and fake moustaches. This week's episode discusses the plight of the Rohingya refugees and was recorded before the recent fire that devastated their refugee camp in Bangladesh.
The Museum of Curiosity.
Hello, my name's John Lloyd and I'm the Professor of Ignorance at Solent University. Welcome to the Museum of Curiosity, where culture and history are absorbed at such a rate we are at the planning stage of reclassifying the building as a sponge. And here is the cherry on the sponge cake, our curator, Anna Tashinsky.
Hi, John.
Hello, Anna. So what's new in the museum this week?
Oh, well, there's nothing new, of course, Professor, because that's not my way. Only old things. That's why you're still here.
Great. Well, let's meet this week's steering committee. Artist Hannah Rose Thomas, comic Alistair Beckett King, and Paralympian Dame Sarah Storey. Hello, everyone.
Hello. Hello.
Now, Hannah, you're known for your portraits. Is there a type of person that is most interesting to paint?
I really enjoy painting portraits of people who are not normally represented historically in portraiture, whether that would be refugee women or women from marginalised communities or a latest commission of a drag queen.
Alistair, you've got this biblical facial hair and flowing red locks look. You sort of look like you belong in a portrait or a stained glass window, perhaps. Have you ever had a portrait done?
Well, I mean, you're absolutely right. I'm not sure the listener can conceive of quite how Jesus-y my general face area is. I can hardly walk down the street without pre-Raphaelites approaching me, like, oh, get in a pond. Queen Elizabeth I is another one I get.
Oh, marvellous. Now and again. That's very unfair.
On her, yes, very unfair on her.
Well, I would definitely consider painting you, Alistair, if you're interested.
Oh, thank you very
much. Well, there's an offer. You heard it here first. How fantastic.
Cancel the show. Clear my schedule. Let's do it.
Sarah, I don't know if you've had your portrait painted, but if you did, what pose would you strike?
Only by my children. They've painted my portrait. Incidentally, they're studying Tudor Queens currently. So maybe that would tie into the theme I'm having here with Alan.
That's my drag name, actually.
No formal portrait. Although I was a big fan of Madonna and Vogue, so maybe I'd be voguing.
Oh, I like that.
Nice.
Okay, so Hannah, coming to you first, you graduated from Durham University with a degree in Arabic and history. You hold an MA from the Prince's Foundation School of Traditional Art, and you're currently completing your PhD as a UNESCO scholar. You've been involved in many humanitarian campaigns all around the world, organising art projects for Yazidi women who escaped ISIS, Rohingya refugees and survivors of Boko Haram in northern Nigeria. Your work has been displayed at the Houses of Parliament, the Saatchi Gallery, and was personally chosen by the then Prince Charles for an exhibition at Buckingham Palace. So tell me, Hannah, art can of course be beautiful, but can it also be helpful?
I would believe so. From my experience organising art workshops with refugees, I found that art can express that which can't be put to words, particularly for those who've experienced that which is unspeakable. But also it can be a lot of fun as well, a chance to create space for freedom, for laughter, for creativity, for connection. Yeah, it's a universal language, I suppose.
And it's just amazing what you do. It's like, it's so brave what you do. I can't...
Yes, it is. You seem like such a relaxed, unfazable person, but you're going into quite... challenging situations, I guess.
You're definitely out your comfort zone, for sure. With each project, you kind of don't really know what you're stepping into. Whether with northern Nigeria, I knew the women had, many of them escaped Boko Haram captivity, so you don't know the level of trauma you're going into or or what you're going to be able to do that's going to be able to help. But I think over time, having the chance to spend it with the women and build those relationships, it really creates a very special and unique space. And it's an incredible honour.
Also, I find it extraordinary the power of human resilience. And I remember reading when the Rohingya people were fleeing Myanmar a few years ago, and they were on the border of Bangladesh, and it was the biggest refugee camp in the world at the time. The conditions were horrendous. And I think the British Red Cross noticed that 6 or 7 hand-cranked Ferris wheels had suddenly been erected.
That's incredible.
And they didn't know where they'd come from, but the local community of refugees had made them, and kids were all lining up, and then the adults were churning them around with their hands. And you just think, how have you mustered the energy to create
that's
that?
Wonderful.
But I suppose you must have seen that spirit quite a lot.
Very much so. The Rohingya camp was the most enormous, sprawling refugee camp I've ever been to. But there's still a lot of laughter.
So I gather this all started with your degree in Arabic. I mean, I think it's a wonderful choice, but why that?
Actually, it was kind of happened by chance. I was just down to do a history degree.
Wow.
And I found out that in your first year, you could take up a language if you wanted to. And I was born in Italy, so I thought maybe I'll do Italian. And Italian was full, so I'd always been interested in the Middle East. I did think about Russian, but I thought Russia would be quite cold place to spend a year. So I decided Arabic. So it's amazing how a small decision like that can actually change the whole trajectory of your life.
Yeah, Alistair, you're a different sort of artist to Hannah, but an artist nonetheless.
That's very generous of you.
Well, I'd like to know, do you use your art for good, as Hannah does, or for evil?
It's very tricky to come in straight after all of that profound and moving stuff, because I mostly just do jokes. And while I've done those jokes in lots of different contexts, I suppose I've had my biggest quote-unquote success on social media. So I think I'd have to say evil, I'm afraid.
Why? Because you think that social media is now just a...
I think I've just been contributing to the collapse of civilization. I'm so sorry.
But thank you, Hannah, and welcome to the museum. You've been to some of the most troubled places on the planet, but this isn't one of them. Just stay away from the Battle of Waterloo and Grimsvötn, the Icelandic volcano, and the giant hornet of Changjiang. And the Big Bang. Sorry, I'll get you a taxi. Coming to you now, Alistair, you went to film school, winning a Student Royal Television Society Award before turning your hand to stand-up comedy. You've appeared on Mock the Week and have had many successful runs at the Edinburgh Festival Fringe. You investigate forgotten folklore through your podcast, Loremen, that's L-O-R-E, men, obviously, and your online sketches lampooning genre stereotypes and cultural issues have reached literally millions of people. You recently published your first novel, A Murder Mystery for Children. Of your many hats, which one do you most enjoy wearing?
Well, it's a good question, because I've done a variety of things. But I've found that stand-up comedy itself is the cheapest medium to be unsuccessful in. There are almost no overheads to performing stand-up comedy, which is what's so great about it. Everything else, you know, you can spend 6 months trying to make a short film only to find out that it isn't funny and nobody likes it. And I've done that many, many times. Whereas with jokes, you find out at the end of every sentence if that was a good idea or not. So in terms of feedback, writing a novel for children is so frightening, because it's months and months of work, and then only at the end of that, once it's been printed onto paper, does it get into the hands of children and you find out if it was a good idea or not. So that's so intimidating.
Yeah, you don't just wear hats, do you, Alistair? Because you robes as well. I read that you were once thrown out of Shakespeare's Birthplace Museum for wearing a historically inaccurate robe.
Well,
the
rumour has been distorted somewhat, yes. I was a student, I was young, you know, I needed the money. I was making a video with an historically inaccurate Shakespeare costume. I thought we had permission. We didn't have permission, and we were kicked out.
Wait, sorry, do you mean you didn't have permission to wear the historically inaccurate robe in the museum, or you didn't have permission to do the filming? Was it just, like, if you'd been dressed appropriately, they would have gone for it?
I sort of feel like the fact that Shakespeare was wearing purple robes was what particularly annoyed them. The staff member took the time to say, well, Shakespeare wouldn't have worn a purple robe because that colour was reserved for royalty at the time.
It seems strangely humorous, because my son went with a bunch of mates to Cuba and had an amazing time. And what they loved were all the moustaches. And they found a false moustache shop. And they used to go into this museum in the centre of Havana wearing different moustaches to see whether they'd be recognised for having been in before. And they were arrested by the police. They took them to the chief of police of Havana. And the guy said, so explain what you've been doing. And they said, well, we've been getting into the museum wearing false moustaches. And he burst into laughter and said, oh, go away, that's fine.
It's funny you should mention that. That's almost exactly the plot of my book.
Is it really?
Which just came out. Montgomery Bonbon Murder at the Museum is about a little girl who solves a murder mystery in a museum, but she solves it wearing a false moustache in
no.
the guise of Montgomery Bonbon.
Excellent.
Well, thanks, Alistair. So your new book, Murder at the Museum, is about a murder at a museum. Alistair, no, put that down. Over to you, Sarah. You hold an amazing 75 world records and are Britain's most decorated Paralympian of all time. You've won 28 medals at 8 consecutive Paralympic Games, most recently winning 3 gold medals at Tokyo 2020. You began as a swimmer at the 1992 Barcelona Games, aged just 14, but you switched to cycling in 2005. The first time trial you attempted was only 2 seconds outside the world record, so you decided to change sports permanently. Of your many truly extraordinary achievements, is there one that stands out for you above all the others?
Winning in front of a home crowd, I think, is always going to be right up there, but equally, winning with my daughter there for the first time at the Paralympics was incredibly special, not least because she sang Let It Go from Frozen instead of the national anthem.
Wonderful.
Which I wish someone had caught on camera. I think that having that home games and the way it pulled the whole country together behind the athletes of the Olympics and the Paralympics was just quite something. And we often talk about, especially at these sorts of times where people are feeling a little bit down about things. It's like, can't we have the London Games again? Wasn't that a really good idea to make us feel better?
Yes. And it must be a consolation in the come down when you've taken home a series of gold medals. I mean, did you have to buy a bigger house? Because it is an extraordinary number of things that you've won over the years. What's your store? What's your display system?
I'm not quite sure there's a system. It's probably one of the only things in my life where there is no system. My parents still hold all of the medals from the Paralympic Games. I have all my world championship medals. I remember my dad turning up on the doorstep with a box of trophies going, there's no room anymore in my house. You have to have these. I was like, oh, okay, your house is bigger than mine though. Take them back. No, these are yours, please. So they have the medals. And I have to, for me, I sort of book them out. I'm going to an event. I need this medal. And he has to go and scurry away and find them in his vault.
Really? The useful service they provide.
Incredibly useful, yeah. Better than Fort Knox.
Hannah and Alistair, I'd be interested because the switch from swimming to cycling, is there any point in your lives where you might have done something else?
Well, interestingly, I thought of either being a children's writer when I was very little, or an athlete. I loved running.
Wow.
So, really?
Yeah, long distance running. I actually took up marathon running in Jordan, of all places, and was considering doing it seriously.
Oh, wow. So you just come on this show to get tips from these two as to how you can affect career change.
That's incredible. I'm only slightly more enthusiastic about running than I am about swimming, which is very unenthusiastic.
Sarah, so I was reading yesterday that when you were 10 years old, your first swimming coach said you'd started too late to ever be any good at it. Is that right?
Yeah, I went down to the local swimming club and was the fastest swimmer in the school. So I was all kind of like beefed up, ready to join the local swimming club. And then I got there and said, "Ah, you're probably a bit too old." And I was like, I'm 10. It was an interesting discussion. And my mum was obviously not best pleased. So I had a lot of catching up to do, apparently, but I was more than up for that. I suppose you could say the rest is history. Nothing like Red Rags or Bull telling somebody they can't do something.
That's so true. Well, thank you so much, Sarah. That was just wonderful. I used to swim for my school, actually, and I own a bicycle. So I have just some tiny idea of how unbelievably awesome you are. Right, Anna, let's open the vault for donations, please.
Wait.
What?
Electronics, very easily hackable. So I've enlisted some of Tolkien's dwarves of Khazad-dûm to build us a stone portal.
Fantastic. Can you just open it, please?
Yeah, sure. We always leave it on the latch. So, Hannah, what is your donation to the museum?
Well, I'd like to donate the idea of getting lost.
That is going to be very confusing for anyone in the museum who comes across it. But why is it that you would like to donate that?
I think the experiences of getting lost, it's like you reconnecting with the world, you're connecting with your vulnerability, your interdependence, your childlike sense of wonder and adventure.
And terror.
And terror, yes. I feel it's been a regular occurrence wherever I've been in the world, whether in the Scottish Highlands or whether running a half marathon in the desert. It was by torchlight and some of the torches were blown out and I was running through the desert and you're kind of hoping that you're running in the right direction. Quite terrifying experiences, some of them, but also I think they're also invigorating as well.
And presumably, did you find, for instance, in the desert that, you know, you draw on some resources you don't know you had? Did some survival instincts kick in? Do you start drinking from cactuses?
There are no cactuses actually in the Jordanian desert. It's kind of a red sandy. It almost looks like Mars. The landscape is incredible. There's something about the silence of the desert as well that is like nothing I've encountered anywhere else.
And you had people with you, didn't you?
Well, I was the first woman to finish it. So I was at the front, so there wasn't anyone around me at that point.
Wow.
I was barefoot, though, which was a very foolish decision.
What?
I thought, well, wow. You know, if you're running through the desert, your trainers are going to get full of sand, so it would just slow you down. Most people at the start line had actually gaffer taped up their trainers. And I remember standing there thinking, why didn't I think of that? I had to rub a whole tub of Vaseline into my feet the next day.
Oh, I bet.
It's funny. The whole concept of getting lost, because I think sat navs, you're more likely to get lost.
Yes. It can be quite discombobulating knowing that you're depending entirely on this thing and you lose your own sense of where you're meant to be going. And there are always so many stories of people. There's a group of tourists in Australia and Queensland, I think, who wanted to get to an island and their sat nav directed them through the 9-mile stretch of ocean between them and the island. And they just, because we become so unable to make our own decisions, they just drove straight into the ocean until they had to abandon their car. I mean, what happens to us? We become infantilized.
No, it happens frequently near where I live, actually. There's a track into Lyme Park, a National Trust property. It's definitely not for vehicles, but it's shown on various different GPS platforms. And it's now got a sign there and stones, and people actually move the stones. And it's really just about useful for, you know, a bicycle, but it's absolutely useless if you're a delivery driver trying to get to the property inside the park where you should have gone through the main entrance. I mean, that's why they invented main entrances, I think.
Yeah.
But talking of stones and getting lost, there's this great QI fact here, which is in 2017, something was left behind in lost property at Dublin Airport. It was a headstone which bore the inscription, "You will never be forgotten."
It's excellent.
I think just because you mentioned, Hannah, that it taps into a bit of a childlike sense, which I do agree, when you get lost, you feel quite helpless like a child, but like you're on an adventure. And it makes me think of when you went into mazes, you know, if you went to visit a stately home or something as a kid, and I'd always get to a point in the maze where I'd suddenly be terrified that I was going to be lost in it forever, which I didn't think could really happen. But there is the largest maze in the world in California. And in 2014, the Sacramento police reported they got at least one call a week from people who had to be rescued from it. Alistair, just drawing on all of your arcane knowledge of myth and folklore.
Yes.
Imagine getting lost in one of the environments that you've talked about, let's say on your podcast. Where do you think would be the scariest place to get lost?
Well, it's very hard because the competition is quite stiff, considering Hannah got lost in the desert at night. Personally, I get lost in an overly large Aldi, so... I've been in this situation. When I lived in York, I used to navigate, usually you can see the Minster from pretty much anywhere in York. York Minster is very tall. Everything in York is quite small. And a fog descended and I got completely lost. And that was very scary, but not for me, because I realized I was the scary thing in the fog, because I had a long coat and my gothic appearance. I terrified a postman asking him for directions. I unintentionally loomed out of the fog at him. So, yeah, so the scariest place to be lost is anywhere near me, I'm afraid.
Well, finally, Hannah, you have donated the concept of getting lost, which is quite an abstract concept to be donating. How would you like it to be displayed? Do you want it in the lost property department, perhaps?
Well, interesting, given you spoke of a maze. I was imagining it as kind of a forest, a maze experience, kind of an immersive art installation, but not
that.
A terrifying experience, but be something full of wonder, adventure, kind of curiosity and fun.
That sounds fantastic.
And you get to the middle and Alistair's there. Is he in a mist? Well, thank you very much for your donation, Hannah. I'm lost in admiration.
Now on to you, Alistair. What exhibit would you like to donate to the museum?
I would like to offer the Red Book of Appin.
Ah, okay. Mm. Mysterious. You're going to have to explain to us what this is and why you would like to offer it to us.
Well, Appin is a beautiful part of Argyll, and the fairy tale version of the story is that a little boy tricked the devil into giving him the Red Book of Appin, which is a leather-bound grimoire or spellbook. Or spaebook, if you prefer the Scots for it, containing diabolical secrets. And the mysterious thing about the Red Book of Appin is that it's either a spellbook containing unknown wisdoms from the realms of hell, or it's a guide to breeding cattle really, really well. And nobody is quite sure which. It was supposedly in the possession of the Stuarts of Appin, and the Stuarts famous for having really, really good cows. And so people reasonably concluded that the Stuarts had secret witchcraft, magical knowledge that explained why their cows were so good. But it may have been a real book. It might have been a genuine text of medicinal or veterinary wisdom. We just don't know, because like Hannah in the desert, it's lost.
Okay, but do we have evidence, people saying they've seen it?
I mean, by the standards of folklore, we've got excellent evidence, Anna. By the standards of science, I don't think we have any evidence. But it's more than just a fairy tale, I think. There's some evidence that there was an historic Red Book of Appin.
Hannah, in your travels, have you ever come across a favourite bit of folklore?
I love hearing the story of the legendary woman of Arabia. I believe she was called Zarqa al-Yamama, and she was named after her striking blue eyes that helped her foresee the future, that she used to protect her tribe against attacks from the enemy. As a concept, that blue eyes give you an ability to see the future.
Yeah. I have blue eyes and I can't make my way out of an Aldi, so
I get quite lost.
Take that with a pinch of salt.
Because you mentioned the Yazidi earlier. I was reading about them and learned about Yazidi religion, and they've got some fascinating beliefs.
Really interesting.
They have a belief that Adam had to leave the Garden of Eden, as we have in Christianity, but the reason he had to leave was because he had to go to the loo. And
I never heard that before.
It's amazing. I think they've got a famous peacock messenger called Tawusi Melek.
He's the peacock angel. It's the important one.
Well, God said, peacock, you've got to lure Adam out of Eden because we've got to start the human race. And so the peacock offered Adam a bit of grain to eat, and then Adam ate it and then needed to a poo and wasn't allowed to poo in the Garden of Eden.
No, you can't poo in the Garden of Eden.
I mean,
no.
Come on.
Absolutely not, no.
Any National Trust property, I think.
It's the same in the Shakespeare's Birthplace Museum, let me tell you.
That's the real reason he was asked to leave.
Yeah, that was...
Yes.
They've got no sense of humour about that sort of thing.
Well, neither did God. So he had to leave, and Tawusi the peacock pecked him a hole out of which to poo. And he went outside the Garden of Eden and did that and couldn't come back in. And that's how the human race began, according to the Yazidi, which I love.
I never heard that. That's amazing.
Sarah, a lot of folklore has a nugget of truth in it at the start, and then it gets exaggerated over time and built on and becomes very elaborate. So if you were remembered as folklore in hundreds of years' time, how would you like your legend to be told?
Add a zero to everything. So so some kind of like Xena warrior princess style. And even if it was mathematically impossible in the lifetime of whatever my lifetime ends up being, she did, you know, 90 games and she lived to the age of 85. How amazing was that?
Something I love exaggerated. That.
Great things. You've got such a great name. The story of story, it would be called this myth, wouldn't it?
You're right. Okay, so Alistair, we will agree to display the Red Book of Appin if we can ever find it again. And if we do find it again, then how would you like it to be displayed?
Well, I think I'd like to reflect its dual nature as either a veterinary text or a magic book. So I'm thinking sort of like a sort of sexy cow, but with a wizard's hat on.
You're going to have it levitating in the museum.
Yeah, sort of cross-legged on a magic carpet or something.
Okay, God, I really thought that Hannah's room was going to be the most inviting in the museum, but I think yours is now. Well done.
So, Alistair, thank you so much for donating the Red Book of Appin. I look forward to reading it there.
And finally, over to you, Sarah. What would you like to give to the museum?
I would like to donate a map of the world. I'm just absolutely fascinated by the planet that we live on, the differences, the cultures, the diversity, the language, the food, the different people that you could possibly meet, the different traditions that they have and the stories and the fairy tales. So, so much of what we've already talked about, I just find it, I couldn't have chosen one thing about all of that that I find curious. So it has to be all of it.
Well, I'd love to know a little bit more detail about this map because I'm interested in the scale of the map. I mean, is it, if it was a one-to-one scale map of the world, it would just be basically be a mat over the world, wouldn't it?
I know, absolutely. I guess maybe the curious thing about the map is it can take on many forms depending on who's looking at it.
Oh, I love that.
Ooh, so yeah. Depending on what you want to see from this map.
Where on the map would you most like to go that you haven't been to?
I can't really choose. I think this, I went to Japan, but I could have been anywhere in the world because I wasn't allowed to go anywhere. I was in sort of a lockdown game situation. So in some ways, although I've been to Japan, I would like to go back because having been to a country, but not having seen anything, it was really quite a bizarre experience.
Alistair, a lot of fantasy books have these detailed maps of the worlds that they've built in the front. I assume you know what I'm talking about. Do you have a favourite one?
Why would you come to me about this now? Why would you assume I know anything about that? Yes, obviously, like all good-hearted people, I love the drawings of maps at the start of a book. Mm-hmm. But I have to say, I also like at the start of a murder mystery when there is like a floor plan of the house or room in which the mystery takes place. Ooh. And yes, thank you for asking. My book does have one of those. Obviously, other children's books are available.
Well sold.
Well, thank you, Sarah. Your map of the world is definitely in the museum. We still aren't quite sure where in the world the museum is actually located, but when we work it out, we'll add a You Are Here sticker to your map. So there we have it. The museum's collection now includes Getting Lost, A Way Not to Get Lost, and A Book Lost to Time. I'd like to thank Hannah, Alistair and Sarah, and on the theme of Lost, here's Tommy Cooper. I'm on a whiskey diet. I've lost 3 days already. That's all from the museum this time. Goodbye.
The Museum of Curiosity was curated by John Lloyd and me, Anna Tashinsky. The donors were Alistair Beckett-King, Dame Sarah Story and Hannah Rose Thomas. The exhibits were catalogued by Mike Turner, Mandy Fenton, Jade Gebby, Cameron Loxdale and Lydia Meisen. The producers were Sam Holmes and Li Ying Lee, and it was a BBC Studios production for Radio 4.
Multi-award-winning comedian and author Mark Watson continues his probably doomed but luckily funny quest to make sense of the human experience. That's tomorrow at 6:30 here on Radio 4. Lambing is in full swing at Brookfield and Clary's concerned about Eddie. We're off to Ambridge after the news.
On BBC Radio 4, follow one man's real-life spiral into gambling addiction through recordings of his calls.
I'm a long-standing customer.
I've done this for years.
I'm Lydia Thomas, and I'll be finding out how the addiction changed him.
It just seems you don't want to pay out when people take winning wages. I've had this excuse after excuse.
What extremes did he go to? And what's being done to help addicts?
get this money back as quickly as possible. I want something done about this. This is absolutely ridiculous.
Desperate calls. Next.